Thank you. And those four words were the first words out of my mouth when John Smith approached me with this idea of looking at dryland sugar beets. This is a semi-arid area. We get about 420 millimeters of rainfall a year, about 16 and a half inches. That's highly variable. That's an average made up of much lower and much higher rainfall, but we're also high elevation, over 1,300 meters or a little over 4,300 feet. And as a dry land guy, I just didn't think I'd ever be working with sugar beets. So when he approached me with this, I had to ask him, are you kidding me? Because I just never thought I'd do that. Let's see. That's what I'm doing. Now you got to do the left click. Okay. So why dry land sugar beets? In 2007, if you remember back to then, commodity prices for things like corn and dry edible beans and alfalfa were all quite high. And much of our sugar beets are grown on rented ground from landlords. And the landlords wanted to have the higher value crops planted. They didn't want to have the sugar beets planted. And so the growers were having some difficulty finding irrigated ground to produce the sugar beets on. And not only did they not have ground to produce it on, but they are in a co-op. And if you're in a co-op and you own shares and you don't deliver the amount of acres you're contracted to deliver, you are penalized. So not only do you not get paid for delivering sugar beets, you get penalized because you didn't deliver. So the question became, could we meet our dry land contract or our sugar beet contracts by growing this on dry land? And the answer was, we don't know because we've never looked at it. Most of the rain-fed, matter of fact, all the rain-fed sugar beets I'm aware of are grown in areas where rainfall levels are well above 500, more like 800, 900, 1,000 millimeters of precip a year, so a much wetter environment. In our area, west into the areas, that's all irrigated. So we just didn't know, so we felt we needed to do a study to take a look at it. So our objectives were to determine the yield potential of no-till dryland sugar beets. We didn't know what the potential was, and then to determine the optimum planting population, because typically when you plant in a dryland situation, you tend to lower the population to compensate for lower moisture availability. So we went to four locations over 3 years. This was done in 2008, 2009, 2010. We had a Sydney early. We planted that the first one at our High Plains Ag Lab. Then we went to a grower's field in near Dalton, Nebraska. We planted the study. We went to Hemingford on a grower's field. And then we came back to Sydney and planted the latest study there again at the High Plains Ag Lab. So four sites, two varieties. Actually, in the 2008, we only had Sydney early and late. We didn't have the two grower fields. Those were added in 9 and 10. Two varieties, both Roundup ready, and that's really the technology that came along that even allowed this to happen, was glyphosate-tolerant sugar beets. We had four target populations, 1.5, 3, 4.5, and 6. That equates to about 6,000, 12,000, 18, and 24,000 plants to the acre. And we had six replications per location. Plots were four rows wide by 12.2 meters long, and we used 76-meter row widths or 30-inch row width. That's what our planter was set up to do. They were no-till planted into winter wheat residue. We felt like we needed to do this no-till to conserve as much moisture as we could to allow this to succeed. And then we controlled with two applications of glyphosate. Glyphosate is labeled for up to three applications at 32 ounces per acre each time, but we found that with our good residue in a dry land situation, we always were able to control our weeds with just two applications. What we wanted to do was just do this as cheaply as we possibly could. A grower, figuring that the yields were probably going to be fairly low, they didn't want to sink a lot of cost into this, so we were just going to plant, spray, harvest, and see what we got. So we didn't want to put a lot of inputs into it. We just wanted to see what they could get. So this is our Monosem four-row air planter, and we're planting there at Sydney into some stripper-headed wheat. So that's wheat that's harvested with a shell-borne stripper header, if you're aware of that. So it leaves all the residue standing. It basically just strips the grain out of the head. So excellent residue. It's fairly wet, except in 2008 we were quite dry, but in 2009-10 we had good snowfall, so it's fairly wet under there. We wanted to just move a little bit of the residue, put the seed in there, let the residue fall back over if it would, but we didn't want to move a lot of dirt because if you move dirt, then you get a crusting situation when you go into a wet soil like this. So we had a Yetter coulter, flute coulter out in front. We had the little trash pickers there to move. We had it set so it would just barely move the residue out of the way so we could plant into it. You have to have a pretty sharp coulter because, again, the soil is kind of wet and loose, and you have to be able to cut that residue or you have trouble getting the seed in. This was our first year attempt in 2008. It was a dry year. We didn't get the stands we wanted. We also think we had some grasshopper problems eating the little seedlings as they came up. But we had a range of populations. So this is we started out dry. In fact, when we put the soil probe in, there was a couple places we couldn't get it deeper than about 2 foot because it got so dry below that. So probably not a situation a grower would want to go into, but we put that out. This is 2009, which was a cool, wet year. The whole season was cooler and wetter than normal, and we had some beautiful-looking beets in there and some very nice residue. And then this is 2010, which started off like 2009, cool and wet, and then in July the rain just stopped and it got really hot, and every afternoon you'd go out and your beets would look like this, and then they'd pop up in the morning and be fresh again. We could actually go out there and take that beet by about the 1st of September or so, and you could move it around. It had shrunk down because it was losing water, but it still did pretty well, as we'll see here. So the plots were harvested with a two-row harvester with scales and weigh crew, and then we'd take tares here and send them off to the lab for tare and sugar content and all those kinds of things. So our results, this is our root yield. This is all 10 site years thrown together. You can see the 2008 years here where it was a little dry, didn't do real well. Then 2009, we had some excellent root yields here from some farmer fields. Hemmingford was kind of the odd duck. We had really good moisture when we planted. We probably had the best stand of any place we did it here, but then it was very, very dry after establishment. And those beets just didn't do much anything at that location. You can see we had really good yields. We were shooting for those populations, but we were figuring 50% emergence. So you can see here we got more than 50% emergence. We got probably close to 100% emergence there. So that gave us our range of plant populations. If you look at sugar concentration, what you notice between the last one is root yields were highest in 2009, that wet, cool year all year long, but actually our sugar yields were better in that year where it started off wet and then turned dry. That really helped the plant produce sugars. So our 2010, we had some really nice sugars. And then this is our sugar yield. That was sugar percent before. And again, because of the sugar percent and tonnage, Gurley 2010, Sydney 2010, we had a lot of good years. We didn't know how to make a recommendation off this thing because we don't know what year. So what we did was we just kind of threw it all together and ran a regression on it. Now, some people might not think that's exact fit, but that's what the SAS kicked out. So what we find is that we were averaging about 42 megagrams or a little under 20 tons per acre over the 10 site years, at a population of just under 6 plants per square meter, or just under 18,000 plants per acre for our root yield. If we take a look at sugar yield, we see that that's a little bit, we get 7.8 megagrams of sugar at about 6.3 plants per square meter, or right around 20,000 pounds. And if you look in the literature, usually you get higher sugar yields with a little higher population than at the lower population. So that held up. Whether irrigate. Our irrigate producers are out here at 7 to 8 plants, so we're not going a whole lot lower than irrigate producers are if we make these recommendations. So, in conclusion, I'm really zipping through here. Root yields of greater than 40 megagrams per hectare are feasible, which surprised us greatly. We were just hoping to kind of break even with this whole thing after not paying the penalty and just kind of holding your costs. We happened to catch 2 out of our 3 years were fairly wet years, although one of them was wet early and dry late. So this was a very surprising result to us. Sugar yields greater than 7.5 megagrams per hectare are feasible. Doesn't always happen, but that's a good estimate. We had no consistent varietal differences observed between the varieties, so they both performed equally well across the populations and locations. Our optimum plant population was between 5.9 for root yield and 6.3 for sugar yield. So we're, you know, we're probably going to be recommending somewhere between 15 and 20,000 plants to the acre, or somewhere around 5 to 6 plants per square meter would probably be the recommendation. Maximum yields would require deep, well-drained soils with good stored water. So that first year when it was really quite dry, we tell growers don't even attempt to do this. But if you have a full soil profile, say 4 foot or 5 foot of nice soil profile, if you can get that sugar beet started, and if you look in the literature, there's some work out of India and some other places that suggest that when you, in England, if you can get that taproot established, the sugar beet is really quite tolerant of drought. It's a non-phasic crop, you know, there's no critical time for moisture like there is with a lot of grain crops. So if it gets dry, the beet just kind of shrinks down and hangs in there, and then when you get moisture again, it comes right back. So it actually works fairly well as a dry land crop. But you do want to make sure you're getting started with a good year. That 2008, it was just too dry to really expect much of anything. Planting into heavy crop residues really helped us, reduces evaporation, and we think it helped us a lot with our weed control. As I said earlier, we only applied glyphosate a couple times to control weeds, and I think if you were in an irrigated situation or a situation with much less residue, you'd probably have to do all three applications. One problem. This is our no-till field after we harvest sugar beets. That's not really what you want it to look like in a no-till situation. And so that's something we're going to have to figure out. It's quite, there is residue there. It's just underneath a lot of that soil sitting on top. Whether we can bring that up to the top, I don't know whether that's going to work. You're going to have to get some rain on that to get something planted. This is in October. Again, we're high elevation, so our ability to plant something into this to get some cover is going to be limited. So that might be one obstacle to controlling this. The other thing is the sugar industry has not made the decision that they're going to let contracts on dry land sugar beets. I think they really wanted this research to be done, assuming that sometime in the future we might get that flip where sugar beets aren't very profitable and people want to use their irrigated ground for something else, and then they might come back with it. We also have crop insurance issues to figure out. So a few hurdles to overcome, but the thing that really surprised me is how well it worked in 2 out of 3 years. And even in the dry year, on some of our populations, we were close to being in a break-even situation there if you figure the grower wasn't going to have to pay a penalty because they were going to deliver their beets on so many acres. So much more potential than we thought going into this. A few bugs to work out yet, but really a rather exciting experiment than one that we did not expect these kind of results from. So with that, I'll see if there are any questions. Yes?
I would be interested, maybe you're not aware of, or maybe someone in the room might be, on the Roundup Ready sugar beet seed, is that still going to be available, or are you familiar with it or not?
Well,
I'll talk it is, but I've heard that sugar beet seed is not.
Well, it went back into the court. The growers were allowed to grow it this year, but they have to follow certain guidelines, and I believe the courts they're back in there. The Ag Department is trying to make the determination whether they grow it without those restrictions or whether they'll put them out and require those restrictions. Anybody else know how that's going? It seems, I think the Ag Department of Ag isn't having a problem. It's the people suing them. And my sense is that they'll get it, but they might have to have some restrictions around it. It would kill our sugar beet industry right now because 98% of all beets grown, and at least in Nebraska, are Roundup Ready sugar beets.
As there are in other states. The reason I ask that is because in this dryland situation, weed control is,
if we had to go back to the old herbicides for controlling weeds, it'd just be too expensive and you would, and plus those require water to be active and this system just wouldn't work. So it was kind of fortunate that at the time we had this economic situation occur, we had glyphosate resistant sugar beets come along. Yes?
Drew, what are they doing when they got the glyphosate resistant?
We didn't have those till you guys in Kansas developed them. You know. We're hoping the winds blow southwest, or to the southeast, rather.
Any other questions? Yes, in the back.
What are they doing for rotation after the beets? Do you guys have, is there any chance you catch rain and get that back to weed, or what's your thoughts on how to fit in rotation?
You know, that's a good question. The wheat would be the thing you'd try to go back with it, but it's really dry. Already, if you're harvesting these the 1st of October, that's about the last I recommend to you, even for irrigated producers. So now, if you have to wait even later, it's going to be, you're not going to have much growth on it. So from a cover, that is an issue we will have to deal with if this comes along. Like I say, we have to wait for the sugar company to say it's a go. They're not going to do that till the insurance company says. This data set, I think, will help the insurance company decide whether it's an insurable thing or not. But not all the bugs are worked out. The thing we worked out is that it actually is feasible to grow them dry land in a semi-arid area.
Let's give Drew a hand.